dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The Bush administration seems determined that no information will reach the public regarding what they knew and how they responded to the attacks of September 11, 2001. Why? It's hard to imagine a benign reason for such secrecy, whether it be concealment of incompetence or error, or a cover-up of a more sinister nature. One thing is certain, unanswered questions and glaring inconsistencies in the official story remain. Finding the truth is more than an academic exercise, as the events of that day have been used for the largest expansion of invasive government at home, as well as invasions abroad in this country's history. Tonight we're going to devote the program to a panel discussion featuring several independent investigators and activists who've been working to get to the bottom of the facts behind the event that many view as the American Reichstag fire, because it allowed forces in the government to move forward with long-planned invasions and crackdowns and corporate giveaways that would have been politically impossible prior to the attack. The panel discussion took place on April 21st in San Francisco, following a screening of the Guerrilla News Network video, Aftermath, Unanswered Questions of 9/11.
Now, I've been asked to introduce our moderator this evening. Our moderator has traveled, as I have, from Canada, and he's here from Toronto, currently in his 15th year as the resident media critic for Vision TV. Vision TV is an independent, not-for-profit channel, the only one of its kind in Canada. He's working right now on Eye Opener, a media criticism segment on Vision's hour-long weekly public affairs program, 360 Vision. But obviously the reason that he's here and that we invited him was because of the program that he did last year in the spring, which was originally titled What Really Happened on September 11th, has become known as The Great Deception. That really was a groundbreaking program, the first program on television to really openly question the events of September 11th. The film has asked so many important questions that still need to be asked. The program elicited the greatest response of any program on the channel's history. And so I'm very pleased this evening to be able to introduce our moderator, Barry Zwicker.
Now, just a little touch about what we'll do. I've been allowed, since I came all this way, thank you very much, to make a few remarks. I think they come out to about 4 minutes. And they're my remarks alone, and they're, you might call them, immoderate moderator remarks. After I make them, I'll revert to my usual shrinking violet self and be fair and everything with the panelists. Now, I think it could help the panelists. This is a bit of a risk, but we'll see what happens. I think it could help the panelists and myself to orient our remarks. If you would respond to four questions. Now, your response will shed a bit of light on collectively where are we at. I heard of a lot of applause here tonight, but I also talked to a lot of people who are skeptical about the skeptics. So the first question, and with all questions, take your time, answer with deep honesty. Hands up. When you're ready, how many here believe that elements of the U.S. government not just knew, but actively participated in the hijackings of 9/11, were, in a word, complicit? So, like, that's a majority, and that's interesting, and that's democracy. That's what it looks like. Second question, hands up when you're ready. It's not a trick question, and it's a sincere question. How many here believe that, by and large, the official 9/11 narrative is valid, namely, that one evil man and a small group of co-conspirators carried it off, catching the intelligence, military, airlines, everybody, essentially off guard? How many people here? That's fine. You know? Let's hear it for minorities. Third question. How many people here believe, to condense the situation into two words, that Bush knew? How many hold? Now, I think there's some... the first one was Bush did. Okay, the fourth question is this. How many people didn't put their hands up yet? Well, that's an interesting group. So we'll hear questions. We'll hear questions from you. What's that? Well, that's where the fourth question comes in, when you don't know. And it's legitimate not to know. Who knows everything? Nobody knows everything. However, I may sound a bit of a know-it-all here with my not neutral moderator's remarks. My offering out of the gate here is this: that the official narrative about 9/11 is a big lie with a capital B and a capital L. My offering is that 9/11 was what the anarchist Bakunin called the propaganda of the act, that it was Reichstag fire 2001, that it was the greatest deception of its kind ever foisted. And that's saying something in light of the long and totally neglected history of this kind of war-triggering deception perpetrated by powerful special interests to sway public opinion in favor of deadly agendas that almost always result in serious grief for just about everyone. And further, my offering going in is that 9/11 was arranged to jumpstart the so-called war on terrorism, which in turn is the heat exchanger for hot wars, these being the toxic tip of the machinery for world domination. At the levers is a clique of neocons that has hijacked this country's foreign policy. At the behest, largely, and of the benefit mainly of big arms and big oil, with the rest of the worst at the top giving the thumbs up and boarding the gravy train. Now, judging by your response to these questions, the focus tonight within the general subject of 9/11 may tend to be, to what extent is this take that I'm sharing, to what extent is it valid? Because there are going to be in-betweens and there are ifs, ands, and buts. So this is going to be interesting. I hope we'll find some time to address visions of a better future, one much freer of the vast, dark, tax-funded bureaucracies of deceit, deception, assassination, and destabilization of civil societies abroad and at home in your country and in mine. A prerequisite for opening up a wider path to that better future is that a larger percentage of the hypnotized public than at present have in their patriotic trance, and that that be broken, and that we be willing to question the provenance of 9/11 and its iconic power. Just to question it is a very important matter. The hypocritical verbiage and bald false assertions of George Bush and his dark cabal of reactionary revolutionaries and oligarchs who mix greed, inept economic management, business corruption, crony capitalism, triumphalist Pentagon saber-rattling, and axis of evil foreign policy theology have been deconstructed by most people around the world. And by the way, I don't want to be accused of plagiarization. Most of what I just said is a direct quote from Kevin Phillips, a leading Republican theoretician. Money power, firepower, and propaganda power, they're all spilling out of the closet now for everyone to see. What's still mainly hidden, still back in the closet, is the power of deception and the extent of deception. And the single deception which, if exposed in a politically relevant way, would have the most impact is the most brazen deception of all, which is 9/11. And that's why this meeting and more like it are crucial. So it's my pleasure now.
The first panelist is Michael Rupert, an independent investigative journalist who publishes a newsletter called From the Wilderness. Rupert is a former detective with the Los Angeles Police who was forced out when he attempted to expose corruption related to CIA covert operations involving drug trafficking in the 1980s. He's also produced a documentary film on 9/11 called Truth and Lies of 9/11. Which we aired audio from last year on the program.
Cracker Jack crew here tonight. It's great to see all these people here. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm trying to Zen gestalt, feel my way through this whole event and put it in some kind of context about what's important and what isn't. And part of me has this great, great, bittersweet feeling about tonight. When 9/11 happened and before 9/11 happened, I wrote in From the Wilderness, actually, when the Bush administration took office in January of 2003, that this was an empire. I said this was a war cabinet. I said that the United States would be involved in a major war very quickly, and that was long before 9/11. I said that when 9/11 happened and we began to see the incredible evidence of foreknowledge, the insider trading, massive insider trading that was covered up on Wall Street. A great many people helped to break that. I played a small part there by disclosing the connections to the executive director of the Central Intelligence Agency's former firm, Alex Brown, Deutsche Bank. All the work that's been done, and I've had this very deep sense that it's moving too fast. And do you have that sense, too, that it's just moving so fast that by the time you grab a hold of the train, you've got the caboose, and the idea is to get somehow to the locomotive to stop the train? There are some times when you don't like to be right. And we have seen clearly that what we are witnessing, and it's been my constant position at From the Wilderness almost since roughly November of 2001, that we are witnessing a sequential war. Dick Cheney told us this is a war that will not end in our lifetimes to control the last remaining significant oil reserves on a planet which is at the end of the age of oil, or nearing the end of the age of oil. There is good data which has now been acknowledged post 9/11. I've been shocked to see in recent months CNN and the British Broadcasting Corporation did an excellent piece recently acknowledging peak oil, acknowledging that we are now using 4 barrels of oil for every new barrel that we discover, and within the next few years we will be using 6 barrels for every barrel that we discover. We are on the downslope of a production curve, and the price of each barrel of oil produced in the aggregate will be forever more expensive. That economies rise and fall based upon the price of energy. We've said all that, and I've said that this war will go, and this war will go to Colombia. It will go to Nigeria and West Africa, Central African Republic, Sub-Saharan Africa, south of Morocco, new oil discoveries, Kermagi, major companies moving in, special forces moving in right along with them. And this is a game of musical chairs for energy, because energy represents the ability to do work, and oil is not just about SUVs, and oil is, it's about food. It takes 10 calories of energy to produce every calorie of food in the world right now. And oil and natural gas, twin sisters, enable 1 acre of land that produces 30 bushels of corn to produce 135. So when the hydrocarbons go away, how do you replace that? And all of the cheap alternative energy solutions that are being offered are not good answers. Hydrogen takes more energy to produce. By the way, commercial hydrogen is now produced from steam, which is produced by using either electricity or natural gas to boil water. Fuel cells do not create energy, they store energy. Ethanol is a complete joke. It's 45% more energy involved in making ethanol than you get from burning it. It's a gift to Archer Daniels Midland. Okay, so what's needed to be understood here is the enormity of the crisis that is facing us. And I was discussing with Peter, I have a contributing editor for Energy, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who's done a lot of research. I have spoken to oil company executives. One, a major oil company attorney who I introduced Peter to some time ago for a story I was working on. We've produced oil company records in what was perceived to be a major bonanza in the Caspian Sea basin of 250 billion barrels. It has turned out to be only about 40 billion barrels of oil. And get this, under the best of circumstances, by hard records, there is only 30 years, 35 years worth of oil left to run the planet if we could keep consuming at current rates. Now, in that context, I look at what's happening at the world around, and I look at what's happening post 9/11. Of course, we all know there's a Patriot Act 2 now that has been leaked. It was leaked by someone, I think, with some great ethics inside the Department of Justice, because it hadn't been introduced. It's going to go beyond Patriot 1. Well, I've written heavily about biowarfare, and I've come to a conclusion, and you can all see possibly Henry Kissinger sitting back at some point and saying, well, the problem is not that there is too little oil. The problem is that there are too many people. And there has been an enormous preoccupation with biological warfare, including some ultra-draconian legislation. And I've consulted some with the Office of Congressman Ron Paul, looked at the Homeland Security Act, and when meshed with portions of the public health laws, the federal government now has the ability to declare an emergency and forcibly inoculate you against your will and incarcerate you if you refuse to receive the vaccination. At the same time having held the vaccine makers absolutely harmless if you drop dead, and you can't sue them. We are living in a fascist state, and I say the word fascist very precisely. In the 1920s and 30s, the term fascism and corporatism were used interchangeably. This was before fascism became identified with Adolf Hitler. Benito Mussolini, I quote him in my upcoming book, Crossing the Rubicon, America's Descent into Fascism at the End of the Age of Oil. Benito Mussolini is saying fascism should more properly be called corporatism because it is the perfect merger of power between the corporation and the state. Interesting, in his recent State of the Union address, George W. Bush referred to the three great evils of the last century: Hitlerism, communism, and militarism. He couldn't bring himself to say the word fascism because he is one. And he knows that he is one. Now, in my book, there's a couple of points that I want to use because I viewed my role primarily as teaching, but I am also coming to a place, I'm on my own learning curve. I've done 28 lectures in the last year with my 9/11. My Truth and Lies of 9/11 tape has sold more than 10,000 copies now, thanks to you. And I get asked often about what we can do, and now I'm beginning to learn and see some things about what we can do. But before we can learn what we can do, we have to tell ourselves the truth about what is. We cannot delude ourselves into thinking. How many people have ever read any writings by Stan Goff, former U.S. Military Academy instructor at West Point, retired Master Sergeant of Green Beret? I posted a brand new story that Stan wrote for me today that's a breakdown analysis, an analysis of the Iraqi war, and it's some of the best writing I've ever seen. It was so good I had to sit down and smoke a cigarette after I read it. Stan has yeah, now he's going to slap me for smoking again. But Stan makes a point that's right on line with me, it's in complete agreement with me, is that the quote-unquote progressives and the anti-war movement have failed miserably. You blew it. And I'll tell you why you blew it. You went out in the streets and you turned out millions of people, bravo, and you said, no war in Iraq, no war in Iraq, as if the war in Iraq was the real problem. And the war in Iraq is not the real problem. The war in Iraq is a symptom, and what happened? We had the war, we had a few demonstrations, now the war is over, now everybody's going, what do we demonstrate about? We have to focus on what's real. What's real and what the problem is this. You have $600 billion a year in drug profits sustaining an illegal economic system that is run like organized crime. You worry about $48 billion increase in the Pentagon defense budget when you miss the fact that over 2 years, $3.3 trillion of your money has been stolen out of the Pentagon. And you have to address the underlying root causes. There are a lot of things that can be done. And in my book, and I'll be quiet after this, and if I go 10 seconds over, he probably will slap me. He'll like it. It's okay. Is this. These conspiracies, you have to disabuse yourself of any knowledge. My biggest role is to teach people how things work, because that's how I got into this mess 25 years ago, by seeing a conspiracy firsthand and almost losing my life behind it. In my book, I identify three key focal points that people haven't talked about with 9/11. Four, actually. First of all, Carl Rick Inderfirth, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a State Department high-ranking official who transcended the Clinton administration to the Bush administration and was the handler for the Taliban who set up 9/11. And I connect him across both administrations to preparing for 9/11. I find one supervisory FBI agent, Dave Frasca, who ran the Radical Fundamentalist Unit in Washington, D.C., that actively suppressed five separate investigations, each of which could have prevented 9/11, and yet he was promoted immediately after the attacks. I take the great work on the hijacked airplanes and the fighters, and I track them down even further, building on incredible research by other people, and I find one single person on 9/11 who controlled or was the counterman point, and that's the National Hijack Coordinator, a one-man position, who was taking his orders directly from the Pentagon. Conspiracies don't need 10,000 people. They just need a few people to be carried out. But what they need also is hundreds of millions of people out there who don't want to assume the risk and the responsibility for getting to the root causes. Thank you.
Michael Rupert.
Thank you. Michael, I'm glad you plugged your book, Crossing the Rubicon. I should have done it for you, and I apologize, and I'm glad you did it. Now, I'm not going to make the same mistake with Peter Dale Scott, because his new book is Drugs, Oil, and War, The United States in Afghanistan, Colombia, and Indochina. And again, he needs no introduction.
Peter Dale Scott is a former Canadian diplomat and a professor emeritus of English at the University of California, Berkeley. He's written 8 books on politics and policy, including Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America, and Deep Politics and the Death of JFK.
And thank you, Mike, and I want to pick up where you left off. I don't want to fault the anti-war movement, especially because I know how much work it takes to put a movement together. But we're facing a crisis right here at home, not just a crisis in Iraq. We have to remember that all the questions that have come up about 9/11 should remind us of other questions that came up. We had another big bombing back in Oklahoma City. And we've had, of all people, the right wing in this country insisting for some time now, and I think quite correctly, that Terry Nichols, who was the number two man in that conspiracy, had in the Philippines been staying in the same boarding house as members of an Islamic group that were associated with Al-Qaeda. Now, what is really going on here, I don't know, but we live in an atmosphere of traumatic events surrounded by mystery. And one of those traumatic events, I would say, was the hijacking of the election in the year 2000. And we're not here to talk about that election, but I do want to say that, I've used this phrase, deep politics, all the time, and I'm going to quote in a moment from my book about it, but that what seemed on the surface was angry right-wing Christians stopping John McCain in South Carolina, analyzed a bit more closely, is a very powerfully financed and organized campaign by Ralph Reed, who was doing this as head of the Christian Coalition, but he's actually on the payroll of Enron. Enron was paying him $10,000, $20,000 a month, ostensibly to campaign for deregulation in Pennsylvania, but he wasn't in Pennsylvania. He was down there in Carolina getting out the Christian vote to stop McCain, and in all, he got $500,000 from Enron. So it was the Enron election. And if there wasn't very much zip to the election, it was because Enron was not only the biggest corporate donor to the Republicans, it was one of the biggest corporate donors to the Democrats as well. No wonder they went bankrupt. They had already achieved what they had to achieve before they went bankrupt. So we are living in a whole atmosphere which is to create the possibilities for minorities to govern acquiescent majorities. Bush never won the election in 2000. He didn't win the popular vote nationally. If everyone who had the right to vote in Florida had been allowed to vote, he wouldn't have won it in Florida either. Just as Hitler never won a majority in an election in Germany, but the acquiescent majority allowed him to take over just the same. I really recommend you read a book called Defying Hitler by Sebastian Hafner, which is an indictment of himself and his fellow citizens for just allowing Hitler to happen. I don't want to sound as if I think Bush is just another Hitler. There are a great many things that Hitler did that won't happen here. We certainly don't torture people. We just hand them over to other people to torture. There is actually still some kind of difference there. Now I want to quote a little bit, plugging my own book, Drugs, Oil, and War. I have a long paragraph in which I use the term deep politics, and this is how it goes. Covert power is like nuclear power. It produces noisome and life-threatening byproducts, which cumulatively are more and more threatening to the environment supposedly served. The byproducts of covert power include trained terrorists, who in the end are likely to target their former employers, the incriminating relations to government which hinder these terrorist prosecution, and the ensuing corruption of society at large. The result is deep politics, the immersion of public political life in an immobilizing substratum of unspeakable scandal and bad faith. And the result in practice is 9/11. Because 9/11 was clearly, if we believe the government, and to some extent I do, had to do with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is clearly and demonstrably the end product of a system which was set up in the early 1980s to help fight the Russians in Afghanistan. And what it was originally was three governments were involved, Saudi money, Pakistani organization, and behind it, U.S. training and expertise, not only to train Afghans to commit terrorist acts in Afghanistan, but also, more importantly, to bring in outsiders, people who were not Afghans, and to train them as well. And there was a special office that did this, the Maktab al-Qidamat. And as the war scaled down in 1988, the office kept going. It changed its name. Bin Laden had already been there connected with the office. They created a new office, which they called al-Qaeda, to continue to train these terrorists, because America continued to use these terrorists and outside of Afghanistan. By about 1984, Casey was the head of the CIA at the time. He, and like Brzezinski before him, they had their eyes on using the war to destabilize and hopefully destroy the Soviet Union, as in fact they did. So the people that they trained in these training camps were now being sent over the river, the Oxus River, into what was then still the Soviet Union, is now Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, And we were actively, America was in the forefront of actively organizing those people to go in and stir up Islamist trouble in those republics. And as the war ground down, and then when the Soviet Union collapsed, and you now had these new Central Asian republics, CAR as we call them, or the Asian Stans, their future was up for grabs. They were being run by ex-communist dictators, but the only significant opposition to them was this Islamist opposition. Iran was making a big push to spread Shiite propaganda among them. That was an excuse for the Americans to continue to subsidize the Pakistanis and the Saudis in creating a Sunni Islamist presence in those states to combat Iran. This is all very relevant to what we're talking about, because by training all of these terrorists, we don't call them terrorists when we use them, we just call them terrorists when they're used against us. But it's the same people. We train them how to blow things up, we train them how to kill people. And we use them not just in the central stands. When we went in Kosovo, it was to support the ELK, which was essentially, or the KLA, I guess you call it in English, it was essentially an Islamist army that up to that time had been trained and armed and supported by bin Laden's people. Mike told me just as we were coming in here that Hosodowski has found a document establishing that some of the terrorists in Chechnya, it's well known that they were bin Laden's, but Hosodowski apparently has a document, I haven't seen it, so I'm being a bit cautious here, which establishes that at least one group of these Chechens, trained by bin Laden, was being actively supported as a CIA cell. So this is what I'm talking about in my definition. You create all these people, and you supply them, but you are giving them leverage on you because you share a secret with them, and they know that if they act against you, there will never be an honest accounting in the home country because there is too much that is shared. Now, I don't have time to go into it. I thought we were going to have a bit more than 10 minutes, but very briefly, the Al-Qaeda people linked up with a pre-existing conspiracy were already responsible for the World Trade Center bombing of 1993. Ramzi Youssef, his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, wherever they were born, they are two Pakistanis, and at least one of them, and perhaps both, actively supported by the Pakistani ISI. And they not only blew up the Trade Center in 93, and some of their members said they were going to do it again, but in 95, the Americans were able to block a second conspiracy, the so-called Project Bojinka, which involved simultaneously blowing up airliners. And according to many accounts, we don't see the primary documents here, that some of them were planned to be simultaneously run into American buildings way back in 1995. Remember that when you hear that America said that we were totally caught off guard and we'd never known about this. Americans had double agents in Al-Qaeda and in the Project Bojinka group, which merged, which melded with Al-Qaeda from the very beginning. They say that the World Trade Center was supposed to, they were supposed to have used DUD dynamite supplied by a double agent, but you can never control a double agent, and the dynamite turned out not to be a DUD after all. So I think that I'm not one who thinks that Bush said, well, this is how we're going to blow up the World Trade Center. That's not my model of it at all. It is that you have, as you go down the line, you get increasing involvement with these people by people, some of whom are double agents, triple agents, and their handlers who know what's going on isn't Turkey, but they don't report it all. And it was a disaster that was waiting to happen, and it was extremely useful, again, not only to the neocons and the oil people, the two big factors who both want war in Iraq and more wars after Iraq, but it was ideal, finally, for the companies like Enron, who had the contracts in Central Asia, who had helped fudge the 2000 election, and are the people who ultimately will be running this country if we don't take it back to them and expose the leads in this mess here of 9/11 that lead back to oil companies, and to people who are plotting quite independently of 9/11 to run America as a minority regime into the indefinite future. Thank you.
Wow. Peter, you ran a little over. I think you're forgiven. Reva Entin, she doesn't have a book to plug. What she's selling is Civil Liberties and Human Rights.
And it's not for sale. It's for free. It's still for free. Know Your Rights. It can also be downloaded from our website, nlg.org. So the National Lawyers Guild was formed in 1937 and has a long, proud history and has survived many periods of repression. The House Un-American Activities Committee called the Guild, quote, the foremost legal bulwark of this Communist Party, its front organizations and controlled unions. In fact, the Attorney General listed us as a subversive organization. We beat the rap because we're lawyers, but we went through that and we... We survive to this day. And because of that history, I have been going to my elders and asking what they think about this period of time compared to previous periods of time. I'm 50 years old, but I was born in 52. I don't remember the McCarthy period. And pretty much everybody is saying this is worse, and for two main reasons, which I'm going to go into. One is the Constitution itself is under attack. The very notion of our constitutional government is under attack. And secondly, it's a wider net of people who are being targeted. It's not people who might know or be in the Communist Party. It's, frankly, anybody engaged in dissent and any immigrant who happens to come from a country that this government doesn't like right now. But the person who I think carries the most weight about why this period is worst in terms of my experience is I'm really fortunate to be getting to know Morton Sobel, who's the co-defendant of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And he served 18 years in prison because of red hysteria. And he thinks times today are worse. And it's a really sobering thought. I'm going to go back to Morton Sobel. He's a remarkable character to have survived 18 years and to be living through this period. And again, it's quite ominous if that's his read of the situation. So you don't usually use this quote, but it was just so telling. The day after 9/11, Sandra Day O'Connor was visiting Ground Zero, and she said, "We're likely to experience more restrictions on personal freedom than has ever been the case in this country." Well, unfortunately, she's right. And then as the film showed, remember Bush said, "You're either with us or you're with the terrorists." What I didn't remember is how many people applauded when he said it. But it really doesn't leave much room in the middle, right? Because we're certainly not with him, and I doubt that we're terrorists in this room, although many of us would fit the description of domestic terrorists. And then, remember, Ashcroft said, "Let the terrorists among us be warned. If you overstay your visa by even one day, we will arrest you." So immigrant became criminal. And in fact, there's a recent thing that came out. Do you remember, did you hear that they were talking about seeing how many mosques there are in different neighborhoods to see how much surveillance should be? Because mosque, by definition, anyway, this is the quote. "This is not politically correct, no question about it," said one top FBI official. "But it would be stupid not to look at this, given the number of criminal mosques that may be out there." Right. Scary times. And again, this is, you know, the way I see it, it's the war on dissent is the war on the Constitution and freedom of association, freedom of speech, and freedom of religion at this point. That's what's at stake. That's what I talk about when I say the Constitution is being dismantled. Thank you. So, and again, this was soon after 9/11. Ari Fleischer said, all Americans need to watch what they say, watch what they do, for this is not a time for remarks like the thing about Bill Maher said, it doesn't take courage to drop a bomb. And it appears that people really do have to watch what they say and what they do. Recently, there was a public call by the Free Congress Foundation and other right-wing organizations for the Department of Homeland Security or the Congress to investigate the anti-war movement's leadership. They attacked ANSWER, said the anti-war movement is being led by communist fronts, and lamented the lack of information about such organizations since the dissolution of HUAC, and called for a succession to HUAC. And for those who don't remember, the Internal Security Act of 1950 directed the Subversive Activities Control Board to identify communist front organizations to see if they had members who were active members of a party. So some people who have been contacted really because of political association, because of political belief. A Houston art gallery had a exhibit, Secret Wars, an exhibit on U.S. covert operations and government services visited by the FBI. In North Carolina, somebody was investigated by the FBI for un-American material, which was a poster of George W. and the death penalty. Prison activists in New York were questioned about political organizations and activists. None have anything to do with the Middle East, and they were asked, given a list of names, do you know? The important thing is that everybody has a right not to talk to any government agent, that's citizen, non-citizen, and juvenile. And the National Lawyers Guild recommends that nobody talks to any government agent before talking to an attorney, and we provide free attorneys for that purpose. In New York recently, well, in May of last year, Ashcroft announced new guidelines which removed minimal restrictions on the FBI requiring some criminal activity to conduct political surveillance and monitoring. And basically, the police, they repealed a New York law which kept that restriction in place. So criminal activity does not have to be a prerequisite for spying in New York, and it's happening in other places, which I might get to. But in terms of recent demonstrations in New York, demonstrators arrested at recent anti-war protests have reported being questioned by the arresting officer about their identity. They're interviewed by a second officer from the New York Police Department, Criminal Intelligence Section, which is led by a deputy commissioner who spent 35 years with the CIA. They use a demonstration debriefing form, asking organization name, organization position, and prior demonstration history. They ask, what do you think of the president? What do you think of the leaders of today's protest? Do you vote? Say nothing. Say nothing. All you have to say is your name. Dozens of Latino organizations, advocacy groups, received racist letters with white powder. There's just different levels of attack of people who engage in dissent or challenging government policy. I want to talk a little bit about safety, because what they're saying is that all of this repressive legislation is needed for our safety, and it's sort of getting into the international and foreign policy arena. But what I think is important to say is to validate the need for safety and security, and everybody needs to feel safe and secure in their families, in their homes, in their community. The way to feel safe and secure is by changing our foreign policy so we don't exploit people around the world. So I won't go over the Patriot Act 1 and Homeland Security, which was alluded to. One way that I sort of generalize, it's post 9/11 repressive legislation, because there's also more than 30 executive orders which have come down, which established the military tribunals, Guantanamo. One of my favorite ones is they created a snitch visa so that you can come on a visa if you agree to snitch on people. But the flip side of it that you need to know is everything about us is now transparent, and more so under Patriot 2. Everything about them is under secrecy. It's a flip. So Freedom of Information Act, forget it. Ashcroft is given a directive that say no, if at all possible, and I'll defend your right to say no. Everything about us is transparent. Everything about them is behind a veil of secrecy, including things like industrial emissions, so we can't lobby about what they're doing in our neighborhoods, for example. You mentioned torture, and there's degrees of torture, but in Guantanamo, I actually think there's some torture going on, although they pretend that Guantanamo isn't really the U.S., it really isn't anywhere, so maybe that's how they can say that the U.S. doesn't engage in torture. I'm going to have to skip this thing about Capitol Hill Blue Report. Check it out. There's all this talk about most alerts are issued, and this is former intelligence officials who are saying that the alerts are issued without any concrete data to back up the assumptions. Basically, they're creating fear. They're creating fear in order to justify their repressive legislation, and we have to stand up to it. All right, in terms of surveillance, one thing that I alluded to recently is in Seattle, they've had this 23-year law requiring, again, criminal activity for surveillance. They're thinking about throwing out that law to be in sync with the feds. San Francisco has a surveillance policy which is better than the feds. When I talk about working at the local level, try to maintain whatever degree of privacy that we have, that local governments have established. All right, ending here, I want to end with Morton Sobel. I finished his book 2 days ago, Undoing Time. I really recommend it. And he said 1969 marked the awakening of the American people to the true meaning of the Vietnamese War. What a contrast with the Korean War period 20 years before. Ethel and Julius could never have been executed in 1969. People could no longer be frightened into submission the way they had been in the 1950s. Now, it's interesting. I drove here, and I hear that Korea might be the next on the list that we're invading. But I think we need to keep Sobel's message in mind, and we cannot stand by and let them attack people who fight for freedom. We have to resist. And I want to give 2 or 3 examples of resisting, even though now I'm over my minute. But librarians, right? Librarians are told to give information to the government, and they're not allowed to tell the client, right? Well, the American Library Association magazine says that when the FBI inevitably abuses its new powers, we will need librarians brave enough to speak out, even if it means going to jail. Support your local librarians. In Santa Cruz, they've actually directed the librarians to delete the data earlier than they would have otherwise done, so they won't have the data to pass over. All right, I guess I'll end on, again, local control. In terms of Patriot Act 2, which I didn't get into and I'm sorry, but it's just even worse. It's just more and more and more transparency, and everything is computerized, and there's no separation between industry and government. And we have to stop Patriot Act 2 from going on. And one slippery slope that they're going to do for us, because they did it in Patriot Act 1, it sailed through partly because it was supposed to sunset. Some of it was going to go away, and guess what? None of it's going to go away. Don't let them lie to you again with Patriot Act 2. We have to say no to the whole thing. I think this is an exciting gathering. I think the 9/11 issue is alive and well. You're a testament to that. And we all have to keep working and demand that this country follows the rule of law, domestic and international, and that if we bring some sense of humanity and equality back to this world, we can all live in peace. Thank you.
And that was Reva Entine, director of the San Francisco chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. We continue now with a question and answer session.
Joyce Lynn, editor of Political Diary. Does anyone on the panel, including Barry, have any firsthand information on the BND intelligence memorandum and or the August 6th memorandum, the contents of those, and how close Bush read them, saw them?
Is that the Bundesnachrichtendienst memo that came from the Echelon wiretaps, or are you referring to... There was one series on Echelon wiretaps of an Iranian man who was making telephone calls to CIA or some U.S. Secret Service that was picked up by Echelon. There was another set of warnings that was posted in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. Now, I have not seen those warnings, but they were specific... that according to the FAS stories in the German, I have the German and I have the English translations, that the German intelligence was convinced that Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists were going to hijack airliners in the week of September the 9th and crash them into the World Trade Center. That's what I've seen about those. That was confirmed. Cynthia McKinney, God bless her, dear friend of mine,
former congresswoman from Georgia, who you have not heard the last of, trust me on this. I was just with her in Atlanta about a month ago. And right after I had come across this information, she and I were in touch. And she made direct queries immediately to the FBI and to the CIA. And said, what's the deal with these five stories and the BND stuff? And they never responded to her. And her comment to me was, that means it's right. So that's what I know.
Sir, you had your hand up first. These are all questions, by the way.
When I yelled out that we should have said not what did Bush know, I yelled out we should change that question to Bush did. And what I meant by did was Bush demolished the World Trade Center as a planned coincidence, first of all. Secondly, however, everything that has been said tonight, including in the film and by the speakers, does not deal with the problem that we have, and that is global warming. I speak as an earth scientist. I speak as a Pleistocene geologist, and global warming is going to produce an ice age.
Sir, I couldn't agree with you more.
This meeting
is about 9/11, and marvelous as
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I'm talking about 9/11.
We have a lot of people asking questions. Global warming is a problem.
I'm talking about 9/11, preventing the solution to an ice age coming. And we don't want an ice age.
Okay. Point taken.
I know I was going to be cut off. I have this and what I want to say about the solution in my paper here. And shut up, please. I have it in my paper here, and I have about 50 copies of this paper. I will be outside distributing it.
Thank you.
Hi, this is a question about 9/11, but I just wanted to mention two historical pointers that are going to place my question in context. In 1968, right before the election, when Richard Nixon was running against Hubert Humphrey, days before the election, there had been information that there had been negotiations. The President Lyndon Johnson was involved in negotiations to try to get a truce between the North and South Vietnamese. Days before the election, the Johnson camp found out that Nixon had been involved in contacting the South Vietnamese in order to prevent those peace negotiations from taking place, in order that so that it wouldn't seem like a democratic victory if there had been peace negotiations between the North and South Vietnamese. He then got into office promising that he would support the South, and immediately after that then said that the South should engage in peace negotiations. During his presidency, there were then a subsequent 20,000 United States citizen soldiers who died, 111,000 who were killed. And then the Johnson administration had found out about these negotiations and were loath to discuss them for fear that disclosure to the American public would rip the nation apart if they found out that this candidate had been involved in the secret negotiations. Similarly, in 1986,
maybe one example is enough, and then go to the question.
The bottom line is that throughout our history, Democrats have known about Republicans sabotaging American citizens for the sake of political gain. They were willing to sacrifice tens of thousands of American soldiers' lives and in order to get political gain. In this instance, now you have Democrats who are aware of Republican connections to 9/11 and all these sorts of things and are willing to do nothing. My question is, to what extent can anybody rely on the government, whether Democrat or Republican, to investigate shenanigans that involve the loss of thousands of American lives?
Yeah. Well,
and if that's the case, then what do you do?
I'm happy to be able to say that I discussed the 1968 election scam in my book, because the go-between who is Madame Chenault, had been part of something that goes right back actually to 1950. And that's the trouble when you only get to speak for 10 minutes. The full context of this really goes back to America's style of living in the world after World War II and how there were people from the very beginning who did not believe in the United Nations, who did not believe in a globalism that was multilateral and involved many countries, who believed from the beginning that America would have to assert itself unilaterally in order to preserve the chunk of the world's natural resources which are necessary to support life here. And I think you're right in saying that you cannot just expect Democrats to do this. If we could bring it back to 9/11, there has been this commission set up to investigate it. You know, I forget there were tens of millions to investigate the Columbia disaster in which five people died. And initially, Bush didn't want to allocate any money to investigate the 9/11 disaster in which 3,000 people died. And then he voted $3 million, and now it's up to about $9 million, I think. And some people have said, well, of course, you can't trust a government commission. I must say, if Kissinger is going to be the chair of it, when there are reasons for being skeptical. But I've said from the very beginning that it's very important to have this commission hold its hearings. The families are bringing very tough questions to that commission. And it's a little bit like the Warren Commission. In a sense, the Warren Commission on the Kennedy assassination was fixed from the beginning, but at the same time, they did conduct an investigation. They produced 26 volumes of evidence, and there's been a cavern there that people like me have been lost in ever since, wandering around looking at that evidence. I think you learn from that kind of evidence what is really going on, and that is something that is bigger than the narrow focus of the election. And no, you won't get it from the Democrats. You won't even get it from the commission, but the commission will be of help to those citizens who are willing to go out and get the truth for themselves.
May I observe that this is the kind of meaty, meaningful answer that I really value at a meeting like this. At the same time, there are 30 people I see lined up, so I would ask this. Each person coming to the mic, please do put a question succinctly. Regrettably, this is... Yeah. I know it's questions...
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, W201CD, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1. or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. What you're listening to is a panel discussion that took place in San Francisco in April on the government cover-up of the facts surrounding the attacks of September 11th, 2001. We apologize in advance. The sound in the last half hour of this discussion is not so good. We've done our best to digitally enhance the audio, but there's only so much that can be done. Nevertheless, the information is, we think, important enough to warrant the extra effort it takes to listen. So we continue with the panel discussion on 9/11.